So we are continuing the discussion on this topic, how to practice spirituality in the context of family life, professional life, and so on. So I mentioned in the first session, I mentioned that cultivating spirituality is all about cultivating the right attitudes, the right behavior patterns, not only with our close relations at home or colleagues in workplace, but also with the whole creation. In fact, you know, the human personality gets a spiritual color when a person realizes the fact that he is a part of a whole. He is not an isolated island. I can just drive home this idea with one illustration. Suppose in your home, if your child thinks that he is an isolated event, he has no connection with his heritage, the legacy, the cultural legacy or heritage that comes all the way from ancestors. And he has no obligation to his parents, then he won't feel that he has any obligation to his children as well. So the first step is to cultivate in the minds of the new generation an idea that he is part of a whole. He is a part of a continuing chain that comes from an ancient tradition. If you feel you have a cultural wealth, a treasure, which you can use, then you won't become a beggar. Why do the young people pick up wrong attitudes, wrong behavior patterns? First of all, they feel that they do not have anything worthwhile to call their own. See, if you have got $1 million, a few billions of dollars in the bank, then if you're walking the streets, you won't pick up nickels, worthless things. You know you are a rich person, so you won't steal somebody's, you won't steal a $20 bill if you have got a checkbook with you. Like that, if a son or a doctor of children, even parents, feel that they have a cultural legacy, a treasure, which is theirs, of which they have every right to be proud of, then certainly they won't feel culturally, spiritually impoverished. Again, this also will reflect in our relationship with other fellow human beings. It also will reflect in our relation, in our interactions with our friends, with nature. So, in ancient Vedantic tradition, there is this concept of Pancha Mahayajna. Now, the word yajna can have a very superficial meaning. It's a ritual. That's what it's called. So, in fact, in Vedic tradition, there are called Sapta Havir Yajna. Means seven types of Vedic sacrifices. Now, if you read just an article on this subject, you will know that it is just a set of rituals which involves that husband and wife sitting together in front of a blazing fire and putting offerings in the fire in the name of deities which are controlling this earth. This is what Dairagni Sahidam Karma, this is a definition of the ritualistic school. That's the meaning of yajna in a very, very superficial sense. So the literal translation of yajna, if you go to any dictionary, you learn it means sacrifice. But in the higher sense, I can quote one definition. It comes all the way from a 3rd century commentary on the philosophy of ritualism. It is called... there are two definitions. Devadodeshana Dravyasya Tyagaha Yajnaha. The most superficial meaning is You offer something to the gods, the deities controlling the sky, the clouds, the water, the air, the mountains, valleys. Behind all these phenomena, there is an invisible divine entity. It's called in polytheistic philosophy. Everything, every phenomenon in nature is controlled by a divine entity, called Deva or Devata, it is called. That, but the most important and philosophically, much more profound definition is this, the Yajnovai Sreshtatamam Karma. Literally, it means any noble act that you do with total unselfishness, without any desire for our own selfish enjoyment, is a yajna. So that's the meaning of yajna. So in the if you take the latter meaning, you will understand the importance of Pancha Mahayajnas in family life. The five yajnas are called Deva Yajna, Brahma Yajna, Bhuda Yajna, Nara Yajna, and Pitru Yajna. These are five types of yajnas. Literally, it is a way of showing our obligation, our indebtedness to an ancient tradition. See, in the context of, let's say, Occidental civilization, the Greco-Roman heritage, which gave the concept of freedom, human rights, egalitarianism, in its limited sense till very recently. You know, it is evolving in profundity more and more. But then many of these, the concept of discipline, all these are coming in the context of Western civilization. It is coming from the Greco-Roman heritage. In the context of Indian civilization, it's coming from the ancient Vedic rishis. In the context of, let us say, Chinese or Japanese or Korean or Vietnamese, Far Eastern civilizations, it could be coming from Confucius, it could be coming from Buddha, and so on. Now, suppose you disown this heritage, where do we stand? It's not any better than disowning your checkbook or the bank deposit that your father had put in the bank in your name. We don't do that, of course, because it's something very important. So, just as we do not disown material wealth, we should not disown our cultural legacy. So, this Brahma Yajna, it's called Veda Yajna, is a kind of accepting our obligation to the cultural legacy, which comes all the way from ancient times, which has enriched our family, which has refined our behavior, our attitudes, which has defined and which has helped in evolving our culture. So this is the first yajna. It means owning up or recognizing our obligation to the ancient masters for giving us this legacy. That's why the study of history is very important. An educational system which completely neglects study of history and sociology and anthropology will impoverish the culture of the people. Because if our life begins from where we are born and ends with our death, and we are just an isolated event, then in what way are we different from an animal? A piece of stone. It doesn't recognize, a piece of stone doesn't recognize its indebtedness, its connection to a huge rock or the mountain. You see, an iceberg of which only 10 feet is visible above the water level, 90 feet below. Just say, think of an iceberg which is 100 feet tall. 10 feet may be visible above the water level and 90 feet below. If the iceberg thinks I'm only 10 feet, see, look at the Vedanta society of which I am a very, very insignificant part. If I say, this is mine, forgetting the tradition coming from Sri Ramakrishna, who sent Vivekananda, and who sent Swami Trinadidananda Turiyananda, who built up this place, and again, on their foundation, their successors kept building up, and this is their legacy. Now, in a longer, and even Sri Ramakrishna himself is the latest exponent of an ancient, timeless wisdom, which comes all the way from Vedas, which are thousands of years old, coming from Rigveda, Yajurveda, Upanishads. So, the point is, we are actually culturally, spiritually impoverishing ourselves when we disown our connection to an ancient tradition. And not only that, if your children do not grow up with the full conviction that they have got something from you other than money, other than and pressure to get higher and higher grades, if they have not got anything other than all these, if they have not got a cultural wealth, a spiritual wealth, which is not visible, then why should they feel indebted to us? And so, in ancient tradition, in ancient days, they used to have this concept of Devayajna. You know, what it actually means is studying the works of ancient masters, reading the great spiritual ideas, cultural ideas, coming from our heritage, and cultivating them and teaching them to the next generation. That's very important. Teaching is much more important than writing in Vedantic tradition. Writing is easy, but teaching means you're keeping a tradition alive, a cultural stream alive. And that's what actually helps a civilization or a culture to remain alive. And that's one way to inculcate a feeling of spiritual obligation and indebtedness in the minds of the growing generation. They should feel that they have got received something from their parents other than money, wealth, which are perishable things. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you should study the ancient Latin and Greek or the Vedic Sanskrit and spend your years for, not at all, not necessarily. But introducing their teachings in modern times, see, in the context of Western civilization, the great legacy of the Greek or Roman heritage. In fact, one of the greatest exponents in modern times of this legacy was Arnold Toynbee, who had his study of history, huge, gigantic volumes. His contribution of elevating the study of history to the status of philosophy. So he saw a movement, an invisible message behind historical events. History is not just a list of events. Then, if it were so, it won't be any more interesting than reading a telephone directory. Or maybe the list of the price list that is hanging on in front of Trader Joe's or Costco. It won't be a very interesting experience. So history has got a message behind the events. Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, Democritus, Philo, the Neoplatonism. All these are great things that have shaped, that influenced all the noble minds of Western tradition, were the fruits of this heritage, this legacy. In Indian context, the Vedanta, Vivekananda brought to this country in 1893, is just one of the fruits of this ancient heritage. One of the greatest statements in Vivekananda's literature was, he says, whatever I have taught, if there is anything wonderful, it all comes from my teacher. By which Swami Vivekananda meant from the ancient tradition, from the spiritual heritage of the sages. If there is something wrong, it is my fault. Now, from this glorious acceptance of our obligation, spiritual obligation, to a timeless tradition of wisdom, that's what enriches a civilization. This should be transmitted to the new generation. This could be done, I believe this could be done only by parents. At least it would be easier for the parents than the teachers to do this. Teachers may be under the obligation of the curriculum or professional problems. So this is called Brahma Yajna, or it is called Deva Yajna. So when we read the Sanskrit word Deva Yajna, we should not define it in its narrow cultural conventional pattern. It has got a universal message and universal appeal. Every culture is not an isolated event. Every individual is not an isolated being. He is part of a continuing, a whole tradition. When that individual, it may be in the context of a family, it may be parents, it may be children, when they are taught that they are part of a continuing tradition and not just a disconnected link, but a continuing tradition, part of the link, then they will take care to take this legacy again to their next generation, to their children. And this is how a great culture is preserved. One of the casualties of this modern age of pragmatism and this business orientation, technology orientation, is this part of human civilization is completely forgotten. If people learn that sitting behind a machine, operating with his fingers, is all about human life, then, as I mentioned yesterday, either they will become monsters, morons, or, well, there are a bit more undesirable expressions which I would rather avoid using. Morons mean you lose your ability to think. Your IQ comes down. Or machines don't think. Machines never think. They work, they move according to the commands, according to the intelligence that comes from another human being who can think. So that's one important. It's called Brahma Yajna or Veda Yajna. So it's got a universal appeal. The second one is Bhuta Yajna. It has everything to do with compassion, developing compassion. Again, it is built upon the idea that we are not isolated islands. We are part of a continuing whole. So Bhuta Yajna. Bhuta means anything that is moving, that has come into existence, is Bhuta. See, an ant, an insect, or an elephant, or all these are different. So the compassion to animals, kindness to animals, looking upon other, looking with the members of the animal kingdom, other living beings with compassion, not looking upon them as to be, as fit only to be consumed and digested, but also as beings to be considered as living beings, we deserve compassion and kindness. So it's called Bhuta Yajna. I mean, our noble attitude, kindness and compassion to the living beings. And the third one is Deva Yajna. So you may remember, in the evolution of the concept of God, there are five stages. Pantheism, panentheism, polytheism, henotheism, monotheism, monism. These are the six stages rather. Henotheism and monotheism sometimes go together. So pantheism implies equating nature with God. Panentheism implies accepting the presence of a spirit, a divine spark within, as the immanent principle in everything. You find in Shinto tradition, you also find this idea in the ancient American religions. You find idea means the nature, the spirit pervading and immanent in nature. Now that's maybe one thing, but here the idea is this: the idea that nature or natural phenomena are sacred entities to be preserved and not to be polluted, to be looked upon with a sense of sanctity and comradeship and not to be exploited. That is the basic principle. It's called Deva Yajna. So, if a person is trained in cultivating these attitudes, then he won't pollute the air or water or nature, or he may be at least aware of the problems of polluting natural phenomena. So this is called Deva Yajna. I mean, noble attitude, an attitude of unselfishness, looking upon nature as things to be preserved, to be looked upon with a sense of sanctity and sacredness, and not to be exploited, so that we won't pollute them, we will keep them pure in their original pristine purity. So it is called Deva Yajna. It's called Pancha Yajnas. Let us say cultivation of our attitudes, our behavior patterns, our interactions on the basis of the strong conviction that they are all part of the whole and we are also part of the whole. We are not the masters of creation. We are part of the creation. And the creation is to be preserved, to be kept in a state of purity. The third one is, of course, the fourth one, for Nishmanushya Yajna is called Narayajna, which is compassion to fellow human beings, looking upon fellow human beings as one spiritual family. That's the emphasis here. So maybe the philosophy of Advaita is a kind of spiritual humanism in this respect. So there is an interesting verse in one of our ancient texts. It's a commentary on one of the Upanishads. The Upanishad's name is Mandukya Upanishad. The commentary is called Karika. So there it says, those who look upon the whole creation and existence as one spiritual entity cannot do any harm to anything, because doing harm to the other is not different from doing harm to ourselves. So siddhanta vyavasthasu dvaitino nischita dridham parasparam virudhyanti taihi ayam na virudhyate. It's a famous verse. It means this non-dualistic philosophy, which focuses on the ideal of the spiritual oneness of not only humanity but the whole creation, it teaches us to look upon the other as non-different and non-distinct from ourselves. So Shankaracharya in his commentary writes, asmadiyoyam vaidigo dharma naviruddhide yatha swahasta padadibhisaha. Just as, we don't hit our own body with our own hand, we with the pain, like that we won't do harm to anyone, because by doing harm to another person, we are doing harm to ourselves, we will feel the pain. So this ideal of unity, maybe this is a wonderful attitude. This attitude, mind you, it will come back as a reward to the parents. If parents could teach these ideas to children, the children, when they grow up, when they are enriched by these values, they will react to their own parents. That's a reward. They will become responsible, protective people who look after the old people. On the other hand, if you just teach them to succeed in a highly complex, competitive world, then they will feel, why should I worry about these old people? Because, the old and on the way, the old become irrelevant because they have become old. The old is the source of wisdom, a legacy. Without the old, there can be no new. The new is the effect. The old is the cause. The new has no existence independent of the old. So the old tradition, if you teach the new generation to respect the old tradition, then that teaching will create the right attitude in the minds of the new generation towards the older people, to their parents. So when we don't teach the new generation, these ideas, then naturally they won't feel any need, any relevance, any meaning in showing any obligation or indebtedness to the older generation. Because to succeed, to compete in this complex competitive society, you don't need the help of the old one. That's how they will interpret the relationship between the new generation and the older generation. But there is something that goes beyond success. And for that, you need a mechanism. And family is the fundamental mechanism of civilized, organized life. In fact, maybe the only major difference, one of the most important differences between the animal kingdom and human beings, that the human beings alone can have a settled, civilized family structure. Animals do have, but you know, when the young bird gets old enough, the old one drives it out. No, you should mend for yourself. But in the human context, there is something much more profound, spiritually enriching, that the new generation gets from the older generation, which what makes life worth living. So this is called Narayagna. Then Pitriyagna, of course, this is a very profound, it is related to this, but it has something more to say about human relationship and our indebtedness to the old generation. It is called Pitriyagna. In traditional societies, many of these used to be looked upon as mere rituals, mechanical rituals. But even mechanical rituals frequently help us in preserving a culture and tradition. That's very important. I know there could be opposite views. Even mechanical rituals are certainly better than having nothing to do with any tradition at all. Because mechanical rituals compel you to do certain things. In the midst of doing those things, you are likely to think and try to go deeper into the meaning of what you are doing mechanically. See, every day, every Sunday, if you go to a church, or every sacred day, special day, if you go to a synagogue, or a Buddhist temple, or a Hindu temple, whatever it may be, certainly mechanical rituals becomes a problem when it becomes fanaticism. That's true. That is true. But just like kindergarten has a usefulness in our educational pattern, so also these rituals do have a place. Without kindergarten, you won't learn how to write the alphabet. So the problem is when you look upon kindergarten as the last point of education. We should not do. So in olden days, many of the yajñas used to be looked upon as mechanical rituals. But then indirectly, they helped in preserving certain traditions. So Pitriyajna means showing our indebtedness obligation to the departed souls. Now, if you believe in reincarnation, you have to remember that your great-great-great-grandfather must be living in another civilization, in another country, in another culture. So he won't be sitting somewhere in the heaven watching the way you show your obligation to him. That's true. But the point is, many of the cultural patterns, behavior patterns, the cultural legacy that we have got, that's our treasure. It comes from them when they were living in this world. So by showing our obligation or indebtedness to the ancestors, we are recognizing the fact that we are just one of the links in the chain, and we are not just an independent link by itself. We are not an independent unit, an isolated unit, which has no connection with the previous tradition and having no obligation to the next generation. So the idea of showing respect and obligation, reverence to the departed souls, is deeply ingrained in some of the ancient traditions. And if you study the history of many of the Oriental societies, especially Far Eastern societies, which have gone through several cycles of devastating social cataclysms, invasions, uprooting of culture, very, very radical, very violent cataclysmic tragedies, if they are able to preserve their distinct entity as a society today, it's because they had one good merit. They believed in family values built upon the foundation of ancestor worship. So the ancestor worship by itself may not be looked upon as a spiritually elevating practice, but the point is that the tradition of looking upon the ancestors with reverence, with a sense of obligation, helps us to continue living in the midst of negative forces, negative events and tragedies. This is what the sociologists and anthropologists talk about when they deal with the subject of ancestor worship in many of the ancient civilizations. On the other hand, in some civilizations where they didn't have this ancestor worship, it didn't survive for long. Maybe some of them have survived. Anyway, whatever it is, these five yajñas help us in certain vital areas like sublimation of ego, sublimation of attitudes, sublimation of interest, desires, and emotions, and behavior patterns. At least it helps us from fragmentation of family life as a whole. Now, behind this, there are three fundamental principles which are related to culture again. They are satyam, ritam, and dharma. Of course, there are three fundamental principles. I shall try to explain. These are Vedic concepts. Ritam is something that we can easily understand. If you look at nature and if you look at our own life, you can see a pattern, a cause and effect link, a sequence, a harmony. See, if you cut down trees, there will be a reduction in the quantity of rainfall and famine, and maybe the temperature may go up, the weather, it may get hotter, and it could affect human life, as we all know. Again, if you cross a big dam across a mighty river, that could also upset the balance of the earth. So any act, any deviation from these five yajñas will have a destabilizing impact on the rhythm of human life. It brings about a kind of disharmony in our individual life. You see, when the temperature gets very hot, when food grains production goes down, and many other chain events one after another, it could certainly affect our life. And also it will affect the climates, the earth, the ecosystem, everything. So any action that violates certain principles, which together are called dharma, will have a destabilizing effect. So these principles are principles of dharma. So when you violate dharma, then what happens? The balance, the harmony of cosmic existence will be affected. Its balance will be lost. So you can see the connection between dharma and rhythm. The word rhythm is something to do with the word English word rhythm anyway. So these five yajñas are considered to be the dharma, the dharmic duties of householders in ancient tradition. So I want to emphasize one point. when we use this word, Sanskrit word, like Devayajna, Vedayajna, Bhudayajna, Narayajna, and Pitriyajna, they all look like, you know, very archaic, ancient Sanskrit words. But when we understand their implication, you find they are more relevant today than perhaps they were 6,000 years back. Because how to live in harmony with fellow human beings, and how to live in harmony with nature, and how to keep the cultural heritage alive by transmitting our legacy to the next generation, and how to remember our obligation to our ancestors, departed souls, who have protected us, who have given us a tradition, who have formulated the legacy of which we are a part. Once we remember this, then on the one hand, we understand that we are part of a whole. We are not an isolated link. Secondly, we are part of a continuing tradition, a succession. In Sanskrit, it's called parampara. Parampara actually means a river, you know, it flows, continuing flow. So this is true in all cultures, in all civilizations, in all traditions. Once we understand the real implication, you feel that. What we need today is a mechanism to teach the new generation that they have something to do with nature and also with their heritage, with the pedigree, with the tradition, and then only they will be able to understand how they should interact with the fellow human beings. Otherwise, competition and success at any rate. If success at any rate becomes the motto, then there is no place for ethics. There will be some kind of enforced law enforcement order will be there, judiciary will be there. But then if human civilization can function only under the stare of a policeman, then there is not much to be said about human civilization as such. So human civilization can function and should function independent of any kind of, overseeing overlord. So these five yajñas give us the right attitude, the right mindset to look upon our nature, fellow human beings, and the members of the animal kingdom from a holistic perspective. And again, its immediate and its most intimate visible effect will be that it saves us from fragmentation of family life. Because even if we become technologically advanced, prosperous, still, if the family connections get fragmented, then people won't have the psychological health. They may have the physical health, not the psychological health to enjoy the fruits of science and technology. So democracy, individual liberty, social tolerance, human rights, all these are necessary. But then we should not sacrifice the sanctity of the institution of family or the institution of marriage as a sacred sacrament just for egalitarianism or democracy or individual rights. That's the message of this ancient tradition. For that, the ancient sages conceived the idea of Swadharma. Now, Swadharma, again, is a Sanskrit word. Swadharma is nothing but what we must do, what we feel we must do to preserve, what we feel is our duty to do, to preserve the tradition, the rhythm, the balance, the harmony of life, our individual life, and also life at the cosmic level. What we must do to keep harmony within, the inner harmony of our own life, and also harmony in external world. For that, we should be able to use our resources, our capabilities, in a proper manner, conducive to the preservation of dharma. So that's why in ancient way, sages, again, it's all interconnected subjects. They interpret human resources. Like deha bala, mano bala, buddhi bala, and atma bala. Bala means resources, capability, whatever it is. Physical, that we all know, nothing to be said about it. Physical health. If physical health is not coexisting with mental health, you know, it will be more of a problem than a blessing. And mind and intellect go together. But yesterday I was making this statement, you know, permanent solution to psychological problems cannot be found at psychological level. They can be found only at the spiritual level. So it's called Atma Balam. I mean the soul force or the spiritual strength. The spiritual strength, without spiritual strength, the mind and intellect will not function properly. Because mind should be linked to something above itself. It should be linked to something transcendental. If mind, if we look upon ourselves as psychological entities, then we will have no solution to psychological problems. So psychological, the psyche or mind should be linked to something that's beyond that, because mind is always wavering. Its nature is that it is always wavering, changing. Changing thoughts, emotions, and ideas come and go in mind, which shows mind is subject to changes. And if it is subject to changes, happiness and unhappiness, pain and pleasure, some kind of bipolar problems at different levels people face, extreme on both ends of the pendulum, moving from one to the other. As it is called in the Yoga Sutra tradition, it is called, you know, when we take to spiritual life, we may show a great interest and enthusiasm, but then after some time that enthusiasm may fade away. Again we may feel enthusiasm, of course, which means mind is naturally, by its very nature, mind cannot remain steady. So mind should be linked to something which is steady, which is not changing, which is not wavering, and that is Atman. So that's why in the Gita tradition, the definition of a psychologically and spiritually healthy, enlightened person is called Siddha Prajna. The ones whose Prajna is Siddha. Siddha means unwavering. Because it is Atmane Vatmana Tushtaka Siddha Prajna Stutoshi, that's the definition. When we feel a kind of inner tranquility and peace, and steady peace, not wavering peace, then our mind gets linked to Atman. Mind gets linked to something which is beyond mind. So, in the Kathopanishad, life as such is described as a journey on a chariot. So, Atmanam Radhinam Vidhi Sariram Radhamevacha Buddhim Tu Saradim Vidhi Mana Pragrahamevacha Indriyani Paranyahu Vishyan Steshu Gojaran Atmendriya Mano Yuktam Bhoktityahu Manishinaka. It's a picture of human life portrayed as a journey in a chariot. Okay, the chariot itself is this body. And who is the driver? The driver is intellect or mind. And the horses are the senses. Our ears, sight of our sense of ear, hearing, sense of seeing, eyes, ears, sense of smelling, sense of taste, all these constitute horses. Now the horses should be controlled. By their very nature, they won't listen to anybody unless they are controlled by an intelligent person who has got effective reins in his hands. Reins are the mind, and the driver is intellect, and the one who is traveling in that, all of us are traveling. So if you want to reach your destination, First of all, you should have a clear understanding of the route, and you should also know how to control the horses, and your mind should be steady enough to hold the reins steadily in our hand, and mind and intellect also should be steady. So suppose the horses are unruly and reins could break any moment, mind also is not steady, and the driver is drunk, let us say, alcoholism. You can imagine you may break your neck instead of reaching the destination. So what happens is, the commentary is very interesting, you know. Horses should be controlled. And they won't control themselves. They should be controlled. You need an instrument to control the horses, which is the mind, the reins. And the reins should be steadily held firmly in the hand by the intellect, by the driver of the chariot. So, mind and intellect, of course, and the reins should be steady. And then the horse will remain steady. But then for that, there should be an intelligent person. The traveler should have full control over the intellect and intellect. Then if he is drunk, you will ask him, go away and get another driver who is not drunk, who is steady. So, who is the real traveler in our life journey? Atman. Atman is steady. So when Atman is steady, then the mind, intellect, and the senses become steady. And the life journey becomes steady, assured of reaching his destination. So that's why beyond deha balam, beyond the resources, physical resources like health, strength, and behind intellectual resources like intellect, psychological efficiency, whatever it is, beyond and behind all this, controlling all this, there should be somebody who never loses his balance, who is perpetually in a state of steadiness. That is Atman. That is beyond mind, beyond intellect. So, if we can keep, of course, this part of the discussion may not be meant for the new generation, but it is for the parents to keep in mind. But if they keep these ideas in mind, then they will be able to inculcate the necessary values in the new generation. So, we are coming to the end of this talk proper. We will have half an hour discussion, interaction. You are most welcome to put forward your views, whether you agree or disagree. You are most free. I will rather welcome disagreement, because that helps me in putting forward some of my views. Okay. Yeah, nice.
Thank you. Thank you, Swamiji, for this wonderful retreat. And my question is this. We've been talking about computers, and yesterday we mentioned the IT world, and today you described computers and how they're computers. They're not humans. But my concern these days is with artificial intelligence, and I don't know how to express this, because a lot of people think it's not an issue, or I shouldn't be concerned, or I'm just showing fear. But I've read that Stephen Hawking's, Bill Gates, Elon Musk, they're concerned about artificial intelligence, and it's not. A lot of people think, We are the masters of artificial intelligence in computer-related things. But the concern, or what's happening, is that these programs, I guess, are self-writing. They're like a virus. You can't just unplug it and stop it. And, you know, at some point it's like, oh, you know, are they going to supersede humanity? So it's a concern, because if we're here as humans to self-realize, you know, could that, you know, could our humanness be denuded in some way where we do become less human?
So in fact, that's true. That's a real danger that we may face in the coming years. Because it takes the world of technology to a totally different level. Right now, we have some control. Human values have some control on how we use technology. But artificial intelligence can supersede that, can take that control away. That's a possibility. But I think as we become more and more convinced of some of these ancient values for the sheer physical survival of humanity, we may be compelled to modify or evolve a mechanism even to control the artificial intelligence. That's all we can hope for. Because there are also equally influential number of people who are fully convinced that these values are as important as technology. If we are to survive physically, so that's very much there, that the conviction is spreading to more and more number of people.
Thank you.
Yesterday you talked about right view, and then at the very end, the gentleman asked, I think, a very profound question: why do anything secular at all? And I think the question might have come from this idea I see that we're on a wheel, and we got to get off this wheel, and we're in a very profane environment, and we just got to get out of here. And with that attitude for living, I can see why there wouldn't be any reason to do anything. But then you talked about those doctors who are doing service at the end of their life, and it seemed to me that if we look at the world more as a sacred place where we have come here to do service, that view gives us a more profound way to do a life. And I wanted your comment on that.
Yeah. In fact, the line of demarcation between the secular and spiritual will vanish as we evolve in spiritual life. But the beginning, you know, when we talk to people in a retreat, we have to take into consideration people of different levels, different attitudes. So we have to begin somewhere where we draw a line of demarcation between the secular and the spiritual. As we evolve, that line of demarcation vanishes. So it is said, you know, work and worship, first stage. Work as worship, second stage. Worship alone, the third stage. But we cannot start with the worship alone stage. You know, we can't do that. So when we enter the spiritual life, then we have to think of accommodating the worship attitude, the spirituality aspect, into the whole scheme of our life. So work and worship, secular and spiritual. And then, you know, even the so-called secular becomes spiritual. So every secular activity can be performed as a spiritual activity. That's the essence of karma yoga. Yoga brings in the spiritual dimension. And karma, of course, the secular. But the later stage, the last stage, everything is worship. That's how great spiritual teachers worked. But we can't begin at their level. So that's why we have to give the whole picture of evolution of karma from work and worship towards worship alone aspect, where the line has completely disappeared, the line that demarcates secular from the spiritual.
Is there someone with the hand up back there?
No, please.
Okay. Well, that some of the battles and conflicts that I remember from university life in the 70s followed the introduction of some of the machine and technology things, like 2001 A Space Odyssey came out, and how the computer was taking over the space station. And so the other thing had to do with diversity and whose values and which great books might be required reading. And I remember the physics department doing battle with the history department and the literature department with the chemistry department over who's going to talk to who with the loudest voice. And what the students were saying, and some of the broader-minded faculty were saying at the time, was let's add and not subtract. So if we need to diversify the reading list, then let's expand it. And if we need to expand the conversation between the departments, let's have a process of more general education colloquy going on so that we can recover from the past history so that the traumas of the preceding decades would be resolved. And so because I was exposed to that, I always thought that we could stop fighting and add more if we were ambitious, that it wouldn't be about, you know, there's a limited number of books that we can teach in those classes. So the same thing, I think, goes on with the family. And I'm wondering, Swami, if when the child says, whose values, not your values, that the parents and children might be able to be flexible about the conversation so that the child doesn't feel like it's being rammed down their throat, and the parent doesn't feel, well, you're being disrespectful and we can't talk to each other. So fortunately, I had that exposure, and I wonder why it doesn't continue. I wonder why people don't want to learn from the statues or the street names of people that did terrible things in the past so that they're not repeated, rather than just expunged as though we're supposed to have some sort of amnesia and repeat the same mistakes generation after generation. But I wonder if I'm wrong. I'd want you to answer whether or not I think too much of human potential, that we can read more diverse books, that we can add, and maybe that is beyond our capabilities. Maybe I'm too idealistic.
Yes, parents can draw not only from religious classics, from great poetry, great novels, great mystical works, the biographies of great people who have made contribution to the totality of human civilization, who have, we are indebted to them for what we are today, on the positive side, of course. So that's also, we can extend that realm beyond the religious, beyond the spiritual, or Shakespeare or Aristotle. Of course, as a student of philosophy, I have a prejudice in favor of Aristotle rather than Shakespeare. You know, that's but both are equally important, in fact. Shakespeare can and can teach as much as Aristotle. True. Different types of people, different attitudes, you know. So the whole point is humanity has a great legacy, and that legacy can train our mind in forming its attitudes, how our emotions and feelings and attitudes can be cultivated and refined, which technology or artificial intelligence may not be able to do. You may live in the most advanced, technologically the most advanced society, working 15 hours in the laboratory or factory or wherever it may be, coming by, you ask the question, what's the use of all this? Which is a question which every individual may have to ask at one point or other. The machine has no answer to this question. But Shakespeare may have an answer. Or Shankaracharya, Ramakrishna, Aristotle, can have an answer, can look at life from a different perspective, a perspective different from that of a scientist or an engineer. Of course, there are engineers and scientists who have this higher perspective. I'm just giving an example. So the machines cannot answer many of our vital questions of existence and life, which humanities can do. So Bobby was mentioning, history can give us some stern warnings, warning signals, and also can inspire us. Is it so? History can give some red signals and also can inspire us, both.
I recently heard a very optimistic point of view on artificial intelligence, and I thought it would be worth sharing, which was, you know, assume that artificial intelligence continues to improve and it continues, you know, not to compete with humanity but become a part of humanity, right? Which is to say, augment our own intelligence and amplify it exponentially. And in that scenario, if you, you know, just assume that it ultimately will be used for good and not bad, like maybe then we have the capacity to solve a lot more complex problems, you know, solve war, solve hunger, solve, you know, competition for resources. And, you know, that the end conclusion of that, of the lecture I heard, was effectively, does that then free us up to spend more time on spiritual values and less time kind of on sort of the day-to-day, you know, the day-to-day competition of living?
Yeah, that's true, yeah. It may have a, it may be a blessing, it may turn out to be a blessing in the long run. Yes. Yeah, please, please.
Thank you for your comments about animals today, Swami. I was so glad to hear them. And I think we can see a gradual evolution in our consciousness of who animals are and what they can mean to us. You know, we've all noticed the changes in circuses that that elephants are no longer used, and there are other signs of this kind of evolution too. And I was thinking of a couple of quotations by English poets. There's that wonderful one, I think it's by Coleridge. He says, "Who prayeth well, loveth well, all creatures great and small. He prayeth well, who loveth well, all creatures great and small." And then that other great English poet, William Blake, said, "Harm not the moth nor butterfly, for your last judgment draweth nigh." And then I read a story, I think I would need someone to confirm it, but I read about Nietzsche, who saw this horse, I think it was a horse, being tortured, and he just sat there and watched it, and after that he couldn't speak again, because he felt this so deeply and made such an impression on his psyche. But I was just thinking about, oh, and also, I know I'm going on a bit long, but also thinking about the great sage Ramana Maharshi, who had this remarkable interest in creatures and animals. And animals would come to him in his ashram, and some of his students would try to chase them away. And he would say, "No, let them stay." And he had a dog named Jackie. He had a cow named Lakshmi. And he had some peacocks and many other animals who would stay with him. And he would talk to them and stroke them. And he was teaching through doing this. But his main emphasis was that each animal each animal was an expression of the Atman, that within each one was the self. And so he was uplifting consciousness in a very deep way. And then also, if I can go back to just something the other day that Peter asked this wonderful question, how can we bring together education and these sacred values? And such a profound question to ask. And I was thinking that when I would teach, I would try to bring in a few quotations by Socrates or Blake or Emily Dickinson and sneak them in, kind of. Not overdo it and not talk about God, but talking about, you know, something transcendent, and give them short quotations. And I found that it was very helpful.
Yeah.
That it sort of gave a different feeling to things. And also, I think we can pray for our classes. This is a kind of a different idea, but we can pray to know that students can have that openness of thought and be receptive to these higher ideals and thoughts. So anyway, that's a long, long comment, but thank you so much for this morning.
The purpose of this concept of yajna is to inculcate the feeling that existence is just one family. In a spiritual sense, there is no line of demarcation. The idea of that we are all just one family, not only human beings, but the animals, and also even natural phenomena. That's the driving force of behind this idea.
Swami, the question about artificial intelligence, although I initially thought was interesting to bring up in this context, is something I've actually thought about for many years. And the question really does call into focus the concept of intellectual functioning, the mind as untethered to any, when untethered to any spiritual values, because that's what a computer is. And when, I think there was a recent article, two computers talking to each other had to be shut off as they started inventing a language that was more efficient than English or any other language. That therein is the I think it's a metaphor for the complete absence of spiritual values, as well as a, I personally think, somewhat of a threat. This, the idea is it can't be used by, it may be used by people to make their life more spiritual, sort of like appliances were supposed to be used in the 1950s to free up people and give them more time. That's always the selling point for technology, but in fact, if the technology became powerful or self-sufficient, then it would be kind of like a virus, I guess. That would be the best analogy. No different than an epidemic, something that could materially threaten people.
Thank you so much for your teaching, Swami. This is kind of a question I've had for a while, and I think I know the answer in my own kind of mind, but I wanted to hear your perspective. Is our desire, or my desire, to want to achieve higher states of consciousness and higher, to reach higher, I guess, is that coming from my ego, or does it come from that higher state, like that channels through me? I'm wondering what you could say about that.
Yeah, spiritual life is not possible without sublimating our desire and interest and ego. The sublimation of our ego is the natural way of beginning spiritual evolution. When we have desire for something higher, something sublime, that shows our spiritual character. So all of us have some desire, But desire for something higher is a kind of sublimation of desire itself. Interest, desires, attitudes, and ego also can be sublimated. And again, you have to remember, this ego problem can be very deceptive. So I can give the example. It is a very funny example from Sri Ramakrishna's life. So he narrates an interesting story. A teacher, or an old sage, let us say an older person, asked a disciple to bring a glass of water. He was thirsty. So the teacher had taught him we should not be egoistic. In the sense, we should not have false pride, proud of our physical things. That's what he had taught. But the disciple, he was so lazy and so disobedient. So he, no, sir, I won't bring water, because if I bring water, I will be proud of having brought water for you. So I won't bring you water. How do you explain that? So ego sometimes can be very deceptive. So positive ego, sublimated ego, refined ego is actually the right, it is the door to spirituality, spiritual growth. That the same, it is the same as the more refined ego, sublimated ego, spiritualized ego, spiritualized desire, attitudes, or ambitions. So the ambition for something sublime is the first step in spiritual life.
Thank you.
See, Ramakrishna gives a funny example in this context. You know. So, yeah. I won't be egoistic, so I won't do anything good for anyone, because then I'll be proud of having done something good for others. It is a kind of, it's a hypocrisy, deception, laziness, all involved in one thing, you know. Yeah, so that's the idea. Yeah, the example from Sri Ramakrishna, yeah.
Namaste, Guruji. My question is, I think, an extension of that gentleman's question today about the debate between secular and spiritual pursuits. I was thinking that, especially in the Indian society, we've always had this mentality that spiritual pursuits is for later in life, for older people. And while you're pressurized to on this path of first succeeding, going to school, then getting a job, doing well, and then immediately getting married is already in place for you. Mm. And you got married, you got to produce results and therefore procreate and then have a family life. It seems like it's already laid in place for you, and with the assumption that much later you can have, you can pursue, you know, spiritual growth. But I think the whole system is very flawed, because you're encouraged to, because I think spiritual pursuits, like you mentioned, is a cessation of desires and attachment to material possessions, cutting down. How is that? For a normal human, it's very hard, especially when you've been doing that for the first 60, 65 years of your life. You're exactly doing that. And then it's like going 60 to zero, and maybe just quickly, it's a very hard thing. So I think why, as a society, we are even in this whole formula of, you know, go to school, get a job, get financially independent, get married, then procreate, and then... So I think, don't you think it... I'm beginning to think it's completely flawed.
No. First of all, the idea that spirituality is only for the old age is totally wrong, and it was not idea. It's not idea that you find in any of our great texts or the teachings of the great spiritual leaders. Nowhere you find. Now, frequently it is done by parents who have a very, as you mentioned, flawed attitude to the whole concept of human life. So if the son or a daughter spends a lot of time in either reading scriptures or prayers, oh, all this come later. Now you study, get high marks. So it is done mostly by people, by parents who may not be very well informed, very knowledgeable about the tradition, about the teachings of the great sages. You won't find in any of the teachings of the great spiritual leaders or teachers, or in any of the scriptures, the idea that spirituality begins when a person gets old. Not at all. Spirituality is something that goes along with secular life. I can give one example. This comes from, again, it's coming from one of very senior monks of our order. Swami Ranganathananda, who was the president of the Ramakrishna Mission. Before that, you know, he was the president of the one center in India. A military general who was involved in suppressing riots, violent riots in the city, was a devotee who used to visit the ashrama. And in fact, he was well known for his wonderful work to enforce, for law enforcement work, to suppress the hooligans, to bring down, like in a Chicago gangster, like that. There was an Indian city where this was a big problem. And he was the one responsible for putting down these violent gangs. So once he came to the ashrama and talked to the Swamiji, well, Swamiji, I feel so diffident, you know, I have to engage myself in these activities, law enforcement, which involves a lot of strong, hard decisions. Don't you think this is against Gita? Then his reply was, Bhagavad Gita was taught for someone who can keep a copy of the Bhagavad Gita on the left hand and work with the right hand. So, if Bhagavad Gita is the most important spiritual classic of Vedantic tradition, the Swami was mentioning that book should be held in one hand when you work in this world, in this secular, so-called secular world, do all your duties and responsibilities with the right hand. We should go together. It is not that you read the scripture and close down, and after closing down and keeping a shelf, you start living the secular world. No, the secular life should be lived when book is kept open, right on your desk. That's the real attitude to spiritual life. So there is no stage where spirituality or spiritual values are not important. That's the idea. Parents frequently give this sort of interpretation. They may not be always well informed. That's true. Please come. You want?
Sri Aurobindo, the great Mahayogi philosopher and scholar, once said, "A god without a smile could have never created such a humorous universe." So I'm just wondering about the Asuras, the Devas, the battles, the conflicts, the divisiveness, the times we live in, with the nuclear energy can be so destructive, and the crumbling of the architecture of human thought. And what is the game all about?
Well, in the Vedantic, from a Vedantic perspective, if you are talking about the creator God and the creation, then the creation is a sport, is a hobby. It's called Leela. So now you play, if you have a definite plan and you work very hard, and then you won't enjoy your play. There is a spontaneity and naturalness. See, you may be working very hard in a laboratory, and evening you may play football, half an hour, that's play for you. But a football player, professional player, he may be playing for 10 hours. He is not play for him. It's real work. When he may play computer games. So computer is a profession if you are an IT specialist, and football becomes your hobby. For a football player, computer games become the hobby, and playing football is a work. So when you work, you have a definite plan. And there is also a monotony about it. A boredom, something that you dislike. You feel you're trapped when you consider it as your duty. There's an obligation, that something that binds you to it. But when you play, you're relaxed. So if you can look upon this life and the world as a sport, so if you If you believe that God has had a definite plan in creating this world, it implies God is not better than any of us. We have plans. We want to do certain things. So anyone who has a definite plan, wants to achieve something, is not perfect. Anything that you struggle for something you don't already have. So God, maybe if you think that God created this world, a definite purpose, then there is something about it which is not so perfect. But so you have to admit the fact that God is perfect. Then what about the creation? It's a hobby for him. So creation is hobby for God. So in the technical work, Brahma Sutta Lokavattu Leela Kaivalya means this creation itself is a little sport. You don't plan. You enjoy doing it. You don't plan. It comes of itself and it doesn't bore you. So there is no definite plan. But then there is one channel open. A door is kept open all the time. If you are intelligent, wise enough, then you can see through this game of God. And then God will congratulate you. And that's Vedanta. So if you can, so those of us who can step outside this wheel, step aside from this flow of evolution, and then think for a moment, well, what's the meaning of life? What's the meaning? What is this technology? Is that enough for us? Technology doesn't solve the problem when I get happy or unhappy. Technology doesn't solve the problem that I have plenty of money, everything wonderful, still anxiety, neurosis, depression, no sleep. So that means there is something wrong in even the so-called technology. So you step aside and then you ask this question, what's the meaning of life? Is life just a journey that begins with birth and ends when the body is pushed through the tube and every year you go to the cemetery, put a few flowers on a stone? That's the whole of human life. Is there something beyond it? When you ask this question, then you are seeing through this game of God, and God wants you to do that. That's how Sri Ramakrishna portrays. No? Mother plays this game. But if the child is not so much amused by this game and sits there crying and weeping, then mother comes to her and shows the wisdom. But otherwise, the mother will give a few plays. The child is busy with toys, chocolates, no problem. But intelligent people who are spiritually more mature, they will suddenly, they may ask this question when you return from the crematorium, when you watch the death of your great-great ancestor, perhaps you may do. Once a month you may go there, or once a year. At that moment you may remember. But if this happens, if real evolution or thinking happens, the door is open. That's what happened to Ramana Maharshi. His father died one day. And he was there all the time. Suddenly he has disappeared. The body is consumed by the fire. He thought, what happened to my father who was here till the other day? Now he's not there. So where did he go? So what's the meaning of life? So he became Ramana Maharshi, actually. You know? So that's how the door is opened. So you can be part of the play, but you can also see through the game of the play. That's how spiritual life begins. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. I think we have already reached it. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu. So today's 11:30 to 12 refreshments. And 12 to 12:30 meditation, then that's the end of the retreat. So we will have refreshments between 11:30 and 12. And from 12 to 12:30 meditation, that's thank you. Thank you, all the best, and thank you for the wonderful questions. Yes.